morning. Now, excuse me, but I told them, if you're going to cut me off, I don't want to speak. You let a lot of people go on and on. You're going to let me speak?
Steve, ask your question. You're on now.
Okay, fine. All right, I want to mention three things about labor unions, okay? First of all, I'm a white-collar person. I'm as white-collar as they get. I double majored as an undergrad in physics and math and got a master's degree in material science. I moved out to California in 1988, and I had to manage blue-collar people for a year. And that's what unions represent, blue-collar folks, all right? That was the longest year of my life. Okay, they didn't care about learning. They didn't care about improving their skills and things like that. They could have cared less about that. They were just there to collect the paycheck. Of course, the bigger the paycheck, the better. That's obvious. That's basically managing the trailer park trash. That's who joins unions.
Stephen, what's your question?
Okay, that's the first. It's not a question. These are comments, like you let other people give comments about their histories. Second of all, inflation. Concerning, that's what unions generate. They generate inflation. I live here at a condo in a high rise. I couldn't believe the things I was hearing about what I was not allowed to do in my high rise. I can understand not being able to do structural work, like pulling down concrete walls and things like that because of weakening the structure, and I should know what that is, being given my educational background. But about the only thing I'm allowed to do now is paint. Why is this? Simple, because the unions have bribed the town council and the building inspectors to make sure that, like, we're not allowed to do stuff like that. I can't even lay down laminate flooring in my condo. Third thing, we hear all the time, and this man over here from the HuffPost should know this, and I don't think he does. We hear this now for going back, 15 years, how the workers are not getting the benefits of their productivity, and that this started in the 70s. But has anybody ever asked whether those workers were overpaid before their real wages started leveling out?
All right, we'll put that to Dave Jameson.
Not sure where to start there. Thanks for the call.
All right, folks. Welcome to Left Reckoning. A little loud, but there we go. Yeah,
there we go, man. How's it going?
It's going well. It's going well. Today we are going to be joined by Dr. Ben Burgess, who just returned from class, from office hours with Charlie Kirk, taught him a little something about Plato's Cave. Welcome, David. Wednesday night.
Yeah, man. I'm ready to be here. Man, I'll tell you what, it's probably out of all of the bullshit and the ungratefulness of that that opening video that we just played, one of the nicest things that they were doing to him was preventing him from being able to lay out some ugly-ass laminate on his floors. I mean, that told you everything you need to know about this guy. He's that kind of person, just like no taste at all and a hell of a lot of resentment.
And it tells you everything you need to know about American politics that he called it on the independent line, because frankly, a guy like that could go both ways.
The Republican Party's too left-wing for him these days.
I mean, I don't know. That's laminate flooring inflation. Like, that's your example. You can't put in flooring. That's probably because your high-rise is owned by a giant corporation who doesn't want to deal with it when they move your ass out of there. But
yeah, and honestly, like
union bribery
with people like that being the folks who are sort of tasked with standing up for working people, sort of no wonder why we're in the situation we are in today. Very good to cast those people as far away from the labor movement as possible. We got a fun show for everybody tonight. We got in a little bit. Ben Burgess is going to break down, you know, some highlights from his debate with Charlie Kirk, but we're also going to talk about whether or not engaging in these kind of conversations is worthwhile in the first bit. We might, depending on time, touch on Christopher Hitchens a little bit. But for all the people who are waiting for that, don't you worry. That is coming very, very soon. A full deep dive into Christopher Hitchens with Ben on this show. Later, Matt has a bit on Peter Thiel, sort of the dark origin stories of everyone's favorite bloodsucker.
Well, actually, the more mundane origin stories than maybe the mythic version of Peter Thiel. Like, you'd like to imagine Peter Thiel, like he emerged from sort of Transylvanian crypt, like 400 years ago, and got in like on some sort of good investments early in capitalism. But really, he was your average replacement level right wing hack talking about, you know, PC culture, and then he made friends with the right software engineer, and now he's some sort of new Warren Buffett, but against wokeness.
So, you know, it's funny sometimes when people talk about, I don't know, how cancel culture and like woke culture and all these things are new. It's like, this is the same kind of boogeyman that the right wing has been trotting out every generation. They just call it something else. It's like cultural Bolshevism or political correctness, or now it's cultural Marxism, right? It's just the same kind of thing over and over and over, because they don't really have much to go on. And we'll get into that a little bit more in depth with Ben in a while. It's the same kind of thing I was noting to Matt before the show and the debate with Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk just kept on bringing up these really old, like 80s, 1980s style talking points about the family unit, and like how, like, you know, if we just revive the family unit, then a lot of these problems will go away. Study after study debunks that kind of mentality, and more often than not, more stable families come from better economic conditions for everyday people, which, boy, makes a lot of sense to me. But we got that. And then in the post game, I just want to say right now up front, because we're going to get into in the post game, we'll try to release it soon. But I just want people to know my opinions on this, at least. It's got to be a no on both of these bills now. The progressives, they have to vote no. I don't think that there's much left anymore after they have just been completely gutted. There's no reason for a yes vote. Don't let them try to, you know, bully you morally over this kind of stuff in the next few days, right? Because they have gutted what was already an inefficient attempt to deal with climate change and all of the other problems that face this country. So it has to be a no. We're going to do an in-depth conversation of that in the post game, along with much, much more. We got a little bit of a visit of Trump and Bolsonaro, some fun stuff to it. And as always, we'll be taking your questions. So to get that, join us at patreon.com/leftreckoning. But before we get to everything else, there are three stories that I wanted to highlight for us this evening. They're all connected in their own way with one another, and they're specifically about what we are seeing done in our name. This is our legal system being used as a weapon against progressive politics, against socialist politics, against, frankly, a survivable planet. And let's start right here with somebody whose name y'all should all know by now. We've covered the story on the show Left Reckoning, Stephen Donziger, who has now had to surrender himself to the courts. Again, this is a travesty of justice. This is somebody who is having a private corporation bring charges against him. These charges and the sentence that has been levied against him are completely they're completely abnormal to anyone else who's ever been convicted of this, right?
They're vindictive because he beat them in court.
They're vindictive because he exposed the crimes against humanity of Chevron.
Right.
That is why they are targeting him. And they have been waging a war against him and his family for years and years and years. And it is only because of the corruption in our legal system, and frankly, you know, straight up bribery at this point. From the get-go, the case against them has been filled with people who take thousands and thousands of dollars from oil corporations or work for them in some form or another. I mean, this is no example of like a fair and unbiased trial. These are people who essentially, you know, paid hitmen of massive corporations. And if you believe in these kind of basic concepts of democracy, like a free judiciary, you should be disgusted by what's been happening to Donziger.
Yeah, it's purely meant to send a message. And they're basically even explicit about this. Like, this guy needs to be sent a message about how you do things around here. And like, even if they might be righteous in some limited sense, you still have to follow the law. And if you do it against corporations, you're going to be harassed until, like, this reminds me a lot of the Aaron Schwartz JSTOR thing at MIT. Like, Aaron Schwartz basically accessed some files in JSTOR, a whole bunch of files through a program, got them all down off JSTOR, as he was allowed to do as a person on that campus. And JSTOR went after him with the terms of service and put him on against like 30, 40 years he faced in prison, and he killed himself. And that's what we have a legal system that likes to get people to kill themselves in this country.
When they threaten
exactly, yeah.
property rights and profit for major corporations. Again, if people are watching this for the first time, you can search on this YouTube channel. We've done a very long, in-depth conversation about the kind of kangaroo court and the targeting of Donziger. But I wanted to bring up three stories, his being one of them, to sort of highlight what's happening with our legal system, because this is something that should infuriate you, and it's something that should also worry you. So this is earlier this week, I believe, Julian Assange, another person who is being targeted by the state for exposing war crimes, is now seeing the continuation of legal persecution that once started under Obama, was continued by Trump, and Biden is continuing as well. Remember, Julian Assange, High Court in the United Kingdom, found that extraditing him to the United States would be a violation of his human rights. And now the Biden administration, following in the footsteps of Donald Trump, is continuing an appeal to that decision to try to bring Julian Assange to the United States, where he will undoubtedly face inhumane and barbaric conditions. Again, all for the crime of exposing the United States atrocities abroad. I wanted to share this clip real quick, and Matt, remember to mute yourself when we do this. This is from his partner talking about some of the other things that the United States has been trying to do to him and people around Julian Assange. I'll edit that later.
We're meeting 5 days before Julian's, before the US appeal at the High Court here in London. And I want to remind everyone that Julian won the case on January 4th, and the Trump administration, 2 days before leaving office, lodged the appeal. And Julian's bail application was refused. So he's been in prison, in Belmarsh prison, for over 2.5 years. In the last few weeks, the mask has fallen in relation to the case against Julian. It's fallen because there was an article, well, it's been progressively falling over the years. There is no case, as others have said. This is just a naked political persecution. But there was an article published by Yahoo News just a few weeks ago, a 7,500-word investigation with over 30 sources, named and unnamed, high-level sources from current and past U.S. administrations, from the National Security Council, from the CIA. And that story revealed that the extrajudicial assassination of Julian in London was discussed at the highest levels of the US government. That the seventh floor of the CIA in Langley, which is the director's office, requested sketches and options for how to kill Julian inside the embassy of Ecuador. They talked about kidnapping him too, about rendition, extraordinary rendition, which is what the CIA developed to kidnap people and take them across jurisdictions to disappear them and then put them in a black site somewhere. And the embassy was essentially a black site towards the end. I felt that anything could happen there.
I want people to really let that sink in for a second, because this is being done in our name. This is our government. This is our legal system. These are people. We all know that the CIA is essentially a rogue agency and has been so for a very, very, very long time. But ostensibly, people still consider them to be an extension of this democracy, right? And that at this point, you should see what that ugly side is, because it is not something, a system that's out there protecting you or protecting anybody. It is out there to protect the imperial interests of the United States of America, and to cover up and to threaten people who are willing to take the extraordinary risks that it takes in the society to expose war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Yeah, and I like the emphasis that this is a criminal cabal we're basically dealing with. People, and it's been operating for decades and decades, and that's even like true as among liberal discourse, right? Like everyone sort of knows the old like 70s Seymour Hersh revelations and stuff like that, the family jewels and stuff. But then it's just like at some point it changed. And then it's actually like now it's doing good stuff. But no, it's still the same sort of psychos that are still planning assassinations and kidnappings blocks away from Buckingham Palace, right? Mm-hmm. And where it stopped, like, is that because the Brits thought, like, it wasn't any sort of moral qualms. It's the Brits thought that's going to look bad on us. You can't do that in our backyard.
And that was the thing that was getting when she was talking about, you know, the situation within the embassy. I mean, you know, the fact is that this problem and this kind of complicity goes way beyond just the United States of America. And again, this is people, again, we did the same thing with Donziger. Like these cases are really in depth and there's so many storylines here. But we just want to highlight something that like, this is just like a, you know, three strikes you're out moment for the American judicial system in 1 week where, you know, remember Julian Assange is not even a United States citizen or somebody who was in the United States during any of these times.
Yeah.
The United States is essentially saying to the world that if you do some things that upset our security state, right, our apparatus of our state, we will hunt you down with every power that we have, right?
Yeah, and either drones or lawyers,
and more often than not, the lawyers can do a lot more without the same amount of public outcry, right? And we're going to bring Ben Burgess on in just 1 second, but I wanted to highlight just another thing that's happening in our judiciary system that we just need to be aware of, right? This is a strike that we've been covering for a very long time down in Alabama, the Warrior Met strike, which I believe has been going on for 7 months. This just happened this afternoon. Jacob, you should definitely check out the work, the Value of Labor Report. Also, Kim Kelly's work as well on this. But this is
those Jacob guys back here on again.
A striking miner in Alabama just posted that a judge has now forbidden all pickets in the Warrior Met coal strike. Strikers are being told to get off the picket line by 5 p.m. or they will be arrested. And this is the picture of the ruling. And look, there's always some snotty-nosed nerd out there who's going to sit here and say, well, they can challenge it, and blah, blah, blah. These things are meant up to be a chilling force. And if you've seen the personal abuse that these workers have been facing in Alabama and all across this country, by the way, when they're exercising their right to strike, their right to picket, their right to freedom of speech, right? These court rules are meant, even if they get thrown out later, are meant to silence dissent. They're meant to intimidate, and they are meant to break people's power, right? It doesn't matter what the final, like, because this is not a legal journal, right? This is real life, right? It doesn't matter what the final decision is, right? After appeal, after appeal, after appeal. When you put in these kind of chilling orders, it's an attack. And I don't understand why people think that is a reasonable political argument to be making in the first place.
Because they're so detached from the actual real world implications of this. Like, you have to think of these things like fucking like a campaign, right? Like into almost a military campaign. There's a certain amount of resources you have, a certain amount of energy you have over a certain amount of days. Mm-hmm. And they know that if you just piss around in the courts, people are going to lose. And it's and stop you from picketing. This is exactly the same day when somebody in the John Deere picket line was hit by a car. And after the John Deere, and it wasn't by like a scab, as far as we know. Jonah Furman's reporting on this, but my understanding is that they've asked for street lights to be fixed. No,
just like the cities were denying, were messing with stoplights. Or sorry, the county was messing with stoplights outside of Bessemer when the Bessemer, Alabama Amazon union drive was going on. The point here is, look, that's a lot of heavy stuff that we just had to go through. The point here is, one, to not just see like, here's a bad news story, here's a bad news story, here's a bad news story, but to start to put on your Marxist cap a little bit and start to recognize how our opponents use the state apparatus. And in this case, it's the judicial system. In this case, it's the legal system to wage class war, to wage, to wage imperialist war, right? And I'm not going to sit here and say we have the answer to how to combat this on every level, but this is the kind of awareness that we have to have if we are ever going to be able to overcome the historical obstacles that we have in front of us. There'll be much more on it, but I just want people to start thinking a bit bigger and understand that these things are not just connected in the sense it's like good versus evil, you know, like working people versus corporations, but tactics are similar and the board is set in a certain way, and understanding who the players are and how they utilize that power is really critical if we want to build movements that can confront that. Because the fact is that it doesn't matter how different all of these fights are, right? Like one's an environmental fight where somebody is exposing, you know, Chevron's, crimes in Ecuador, right? Another one is somebody exposing American war crimes, you know, abroad, right? And the other one is people standing up for fair wages in the United States of America, right? But across all three of these, there are similar systems and structures that are used to sort of smack down any kind of oppositional effort to their power, right? And understanding that connection is really critical if we want to break it.
Absolutely.
Well, to sort of provide us, this is still going to be very serious and high stakes, but after sort of going through those heavy things, we're really excited to be joined by our friend Ben Burgess. We will be right back in about 10 seconds. All right, everybody, just want to make sure I had all the videos set up because we have some live footage. Without further ado, let's bring on our friend Ben Burgess. How are you doing, Ben?
I am really good. How are you?
We are good. I hope you're liking the new setup. We're still sort of learning the ins and outs of it, but it's been pretty fun. It's good to see you, brother, man. I really enjoyed watching your lessons last night to the little student Charlie Kirk. It seemed like it was a pretty interesting. I mean, could you tell us a little bit, we're going to get into the structure of the debate, but could you tell us a little bit about the experience and like where it was filmed and all that kind of stuff, a little behind the scenes preview?
Yeah, sure. So it was filmed at the Turning Points USA studio in Phoenix, Arizona, which, feels very strange because I have seen Charlie interview Donald Trump, and he starts the interview by saying, "Welcome to Arizona." So even though the background looks different, I'm sure it's somewhere else in that building. it's crazy. I mean, like I, especially because a couple weeks before I was in New York, and while I was there, I got to see where the Jacobin offices are in Brooklyn, and even though I've been writing for them but on the masthead for a while now, most of that was in lockdown, and I'd never gone over there before, and so that's like one floor of a nondescript building, and
just luxury. It's like Tory Burch.
While I was there, Bhaskar was nice enough to get together, party on the roof, which was great. But the financial outlay for that was ordered a pizza. Right? I guess somebody else also bought some beer, but that was that.
Can I just say not to bash Jack's offices too much, but I went there to spec out a studio for something I think Michael is going to do there. I can't remember exactly the scenario, but not the greatest place for a studio. So.
I think while I was there, the door to be kept open, the door to the hallway was being propped up with a broom. Meanwhile, Turning Points USA building in Phoenix, they got their own building. It says Turning Points USA in giant letters on the outside. You go through some sliding glass doors, and there are Turning Points USA floor mats, this was funny enough. I actually had to take a picture of it. The men's room has the Turning Points USA logo on it.
Very weird.
presumably the women's room does too, but it's just everything there is plastered with it. And there's a green room, and actually in advance, I had a writer, a special food or drink request. I was tempted for half a second to ask for some crazy rock star shit. I want the bowl with only round M&Ms. Yeah. But you know, I like a chump, I said, nah, I'm good. You know,
I don't know, man, you should have gone big. They got the money. I mean, there's no doubt about it that they have funds behind the whole operation, but I don't know. I don't mean to bring you on here to sort of bash that whole operation too much. We've got to get onto the substance of the debate, but I found the studio to be a little shabbier than I had expected. I thought that the green grass on the floor was very strange. I don't know. I mean, it seems like they had the money to do what they wanted, but I don't think they had the kind of aesthetic eye to sort of build a beautiful stage. But I will.
Yeah, they should bring out a better designer. But but the fundraising is clearly, you know, the design maybe has room for improvement, but you know, the fundraising, like whoever's in charge of that, they got it.
The right is getting better at interior design, and the left is barefoot.
But to pick on what David said, like, I was impressed Charlie took the debate. I think, like, to credit Charlie a little bit, he's more competent than a lot of the his class, frankly, of pundit. He debated Sam Cedar, obviously. He'll take these debates. So I'm curious, like, what was, because Charlie, you know, he brought his binder of notes to your office hours. I'm curious, like, what the preparation, what was, because it's always like one thing people have to ask, because I think the key thing about debating people is to know what you're walking into, right? And like what sort of constraints are being placed on it, who has final edit, that sort of stuff like that. So I'm curious, like, the lead up to it, how did that work?
Yeah, so I guess I should say, for anybody who's not familiar, that the way this originally came about was that there's an organization called Town Circle with an S that's like a debate hosted website, and what they do is they raise money. It's like the structure of GoFundMe, that, you know, the pledges are only collected if the thing happens, for people to donate to charity. And we actually ended up raising enough, apparently, to buy like 11,000 and some meals. We were pretty sure that it was not going to happen. Like, I did an episode with Nando and Jason Miles just before it was supposed to expire. I was like, all right, well, this is about to expire. Let's at least do an episode of, like, you know, Kirk debunking and stuff like that, and, you know, give a little last push. And then at the last minute, they accepted it. So I do give them credit for that. I think the very last thing I say, so there was the kind of main debate, which was recorded as an episode of his new show, Debate Night with Charlie Kirk, and that there was essentially like a post-game hour. He put out the whole thing on his personal channel, and we were, like, when we were kind of negotiating about it in advance, you know, they said they'd give the whole thing to us. And you know, there was a lot of like, okay, but like, really, this is like every minute of it, right? Every word. And they said they would, and you know, credit where credit is due. You know, they kept it. I mean, like when I reviewed it, it's like, no, that's definitely everything. Including, actually, it's kind of funny because part of what they sent us was the raw footage that includes, I posted this on Twitter, like, I just clipped it out, my wife Jennifer coming up to me to give me her review, you know, in between the main part and the post game. So not that much shows up on the audio, but I think you get a general tone that we both thought it had gone well. But I was just going to say, like, So I think that does get some credit for it. In fact, the very last thing I say at the end of the bonus half is, you know, sort of on one level, I'm being nice. On another level, I'm being kind of mean to other people. Because one of the last things I say is, hey, I'll give you credit for actually doing this. A lot of conservatives, you know, don't seem to be interested in, you know, in doing the same thing.
Yeah. No, and I think it was, I mean, it was really telling. I mean, it was interesting to see somebody have to engage. And I think let's get to some of the actual, like, content from the debate. We have some specific clips from here, but feel free to, you know, bring up any specific points that you'd like to sort of, you know, rehash. But I mean, it's one of those things, I don't want to sit here and do like 2 hours of watching it and pausing it, but you really could stop it throughout, because Ben, you were really on form throughout. I thought you had a great showing. I want to highlight some of the arguments that I thought were really strong, especially when dealing with conservatives. And this first one here is, I hope is the right one, is a bit about freedom and health insurance, which I thought was a really good point.
You know, when we talk about things like healthcare, oftentimes people on my side will emphasize the fact that life expectancy is higher in places like Canada, the UK, where they have socialized healthcare and infant mortality. And you know, you want to talk about families, you know, people's babies are less likely to die in places like Canada, the UK than in the United States, and mortality amenable to healthcare, which is a stats nerd way of saying that you're less likely to die from treatable diseases is lower in those places. And I think all those are true and important, but I don't think it's the most important thing because most of us are not on the verge of dying most of the time. Most of us are not worried that our babies are going to die most of the time. The biggest way, I think, that not providing everybody with healthcare as a right affects the lives of most people is that it makes us less free because people are a lot less likely to leave jobs that they hate if they're worried about, will I still have health insurance? Will my family still have health insurance? People stay in those jobs and don't pursue their dreams all the time because of that. There are people, you know, I think people who are in good families and they want to keep them together, absolutely, they should be able to do that. But there are also people who stay in bad or even abusive marriages because they cannot afford to lose their spousal health insurance. And so I think that we're not only happier and we not only live longer, but I think we're also freer if we take care of those things.
So that's an interesting point. And what you're articulating, as before we get into the back and forth here, is what Lyndon Baines Johnson would call freedom from necessity, which is something I take exception with. I do not believe the state should play an interventionist role in saying that it is the role of government to say that you should be free from wants or necessity. I would argue that through a natural rights compact, that you should be free to pursue virtue. And that's not to say you shouldn't have a social safety net, which far too often becomes a hammock, not a social safety net. But I think the design of government and the state, which is really what we're debating here, right? What is the role of public policy should be supporting things that are objectively good for people, for children, for the nation, and for the country. And so I'm happy to go into the kind of three categories that are common points of Democrat socialists next. Healthcare, union membership, and kind of the development of unions and minimum wage laws, because I would argue that some of your policy prescriptions do the opposite. They don't actually help working families. They actually raise prices.
And then we get a very funny kind of newsreel music plan. What were you going to say, Ben?
Yeah. So just to give a little context for this exchange, the reason that when I was talking, I kept talking about families is that the way the debate started was that I kind of gave the, you know, the 2-minute opening statement, which is what I had, that like I'd, you know, was essentially the reason that I wanted to do this debate in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. Like this is like the main thing I wanted to say to him, which was, and kind of get him to answer to, which is, hey, you say you're a populist. That's how you brand yourself now. But if you're such a populist, why aren't you supporting, you know, raising people's wages and giving them health care and making it easier for them to organize a union so they can have some say? And in his response, when he was trying to define what conservative populism is, essentially the main thing that he was doing was just saying the word family a lot, right? Family is valuable. Family is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and so I kept kind of trying to tie it back. That's like, okay, great. But like, what are you actually going to, yes, families are not. Nice. I agree, right? We probably disagree about which things count as families, but whatever. Like, families are great. You know, like, now that we've established that point, can we talk about what we're going to do to actually help them?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's so funny in the context of two things. One is this, did you see this dad's on duty thing in Louisiana?
Yeah.
We don't have this clip, but it's basically like there's a whole bunch of violence issues at this Louisiana high school. And instead they had a bunch of dads come, instead of cops, a bunch of the dads come and basically like be in the hallways. And lo and behold, that actually did something for violence. And it's just clear that like they shouldn't be at their boss all the time. Their family needs them more. That's just a good microcosm of the society and all. And also in the context of the parental leave thing, people just confuse that a dad would want to spend time with a newborn. Like, I know a new dad, and that parental leave policy that his business had was one of the most like magical time of his life because he didn't have to care about work and he could just bond with, like, I mean, why that you need to spell this out is amazing to me. But yeah, this family thing, like, can an interventionist state do stuff for families or no?
No, I mean, it's the only social organization that they truly believe in, which is which is frankly funny because it's the one that, you know, this it's the hardest for the state to sort of touch, right?
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, the thing that was funny about the debate is, like, I mean, I noted the family stuff, too, because Ben actually has a really good opening about, you know, why some of the, you know, what he calls like baby steps to socialism would help out, you know, the people. And if that's something that you care about, then, you know, you should be a socialist or a democratic socialist. But it was
Democratic socialist is apparently the term.
I was about to say, well, he's, and the thing is, for people who didn't watch the debate the whole time, I kept that clip going a little bit long because we're not going to be playing too much of Kirk here. And this is not because we're afraid of his arguments or anything like that. It's because he pretty much does the same thing where Ben makes a point and then he says, interesting. And then he asks him another question, right? And then, you know,
or quotes like LBJ or the Black Panthers or something like that to say, well, this is a contrary view. Anyway, who knows? Let's go on to the next thing.
Here's a quote, like a random quote, sometimes out of context, sometimes just throwing it in there. And then would also continue to call Ben a Democrat socialist, which I do not think was a mistake. I think that was very much like trying to tie you to the toxic brand of you know, being a Democrat, which none of us are. Anyway,
yeah, no, absolutely. Some of the quotes were pretty funny too, because I don't want to be like, I don't know. I feel mean talking too much about the binder, but like the binder was funny, and
I want to read it.
I would be curious too.
Let's read that,
because I was curious where this. You know, I wonder how much of that binder is like filled with Stalin stuff, which Ben was not going to. Ben's not the guy to like hit with Stalin things, you know. But I bet you there's a bit, big bit.
Well, although it's funny, right? Because he didn't actually bring in Stalin. It was actually surprising. I was waiting
for that the whole time.
Yeah. But he did, like, at one point, he was trying to, like, pin me down to some view that I was supposed to agree with. He actually starts reading a quote from Woodrow Wilson, and I'm like, you think I like Woodrow Wilson? I mean, the guy who, like, put Debs in jail for opposing World War I, you think that's my guy?
Yeah, that was very funny.
No, but, like, I mean, I'd like to explore this a little bit. I mean, not to get too behind the scenes, but I think this freedom point is really crucial. And it's actually like there's a lot of openings that we have as the left to sort of own that. I think a lot of people are so timid about owning, you know, the kind of talking about, for example, personal freedom. I mean, you know, Oscar Wilde has that great quote, right? It's like only under socialism can, like, you know, personal, what is it? Selfishness, the exact phrasing that he uses, but, like, you know, like the art of like living for your own self, right? Can only ever really be achieved under socialism for the material reasons that Ben, you're sort of noting there when you're saying, like, yeah, you have a lot more freedom when you're not worried about losing your health insurance. I'd also note, not that this would convince Kirk, this is one of the big things that you saw in Bessemer, Alabama, when they did the postmortem as to why people did not want to join the union. It wasn't because they didn't think that the union was good or that they didn't even want a union. It was because they were afraid that Amazon would take away their health insurance and it would take too long to negotiate, you know, healthcare for themselves, right? So in that sense, their personal choice, right, is being infringed upon by the market. And I think that there's a lot of space for us to start trying to say, like, you know, y'all are not the party of freedom at all. Y'all sort of represent a movement of unfreedom.
No, exactly. I mean, that this is like what, and actually there's a part of the debate where we do very directly get into this, because he starts talking about Norway, and in the course of it, he says some, you know, he's doing the usual conservative thing where on the one hand, it's the meme, right? On the one hand, they want to say there's absolutely nothing socialist about Norway. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's like, we can't have all the Norway stuff because that'd be too socialist. And in the course of that, right, he kind of brought up the, I don't even remember, is the AEI or Cato or, you know, one of those, you know, their freedom index, where Norway is on the freedom index. And you know, the point I tried to make there is like, yeah, but I mean, what, okay. First of all, methodology of those lists is always bizarre. Like the abortion rights doesn't get you any points, but like allowing raw milk does. It's all shit like that. But like also, the more important point is what those guys mean by economic freedom is exactly the opposite of what we mean. And it's the opposite of the kind that would matter to most people, that, you know, what they mean by economic freedom is the freedom of business owners to do whatever they want with their business, which is not only completely different, but like very, very often at odds with the freedom of the people who work for those companies to do what they want with their lives.
And I would add to that too, just while we're sort of addressing his main claim about the family, right? And like that being the unit. Again, I think, you know, it's important not to lean too far into that on our side, you know, just because it obviously is like an extremely conservative notion that the only thing that matters is, you know, women and men having babies, you know, that kind of thing, right? And push back against, I think, very well. But, you know, we should also want to live in a society where people who want to have children
are
able to do so. And I think this actually is a very socialist kind of conception as well, frankly, a very basic one. But when we're talking about those policies, like later in the debate, you know, he talks about some form of where he sort of pushes back against the bosses, which is that he thinks that, you know, maybe people don't have to work too much, right? So like, you know, not having to stay at the office, you know, an extra 10 hours a week when you could be playing with your kids, like allocating time better at the workplace. I'm sorry, like if you're saying that you're a pro-family person, I think that there's a much more attractive argument to be saying, hey, we should be providing money to people who are having children so that you can buy them nice things. We should be providing paid leave and vacation so that you can spend, you know, formative memories with them, rather than just this kind of like immaterial point about like, oh, I think that dads should have to do less overtime so they can be with their kids. But it's just not a very convincing, like, do you know what the family's like kind of?
Especially because notice what he's not saying. What he's not saying is how he's going to bring about that result. He doesn't like it that people have to come in for an extra 10 hours the weekends. They can't see their kids. But it's like, okay, so do we have a Charlie Kirk policy for addressing this? I haven't heard one. And I think, like, I've got one. I want to make it easier to organize a union so you can, like, negotiate stuff like scheduling. Like, that would actually help with that. I don't know what he wants that would actually help with that. Not to even mention, I mean, obviously – in fact, I really liked it the day after we finally got to air this, because the deal was that they were going to wait until the 21st, and you know, part of the agreement was that they were going to get to air it first. But you know, so we, you know, the next episode we had was on the 25th. The day after that, you know, Bernie Sanders had this great tweet about the number of days of paid leave, you know, that like new moms get in all these different countries, and you know, it's like down in like the 30th place or something. It's like United States of America, zero. It's like, okay, well, if you really care about what Charlie Kirk says he cares about, I mean, this seems like an obvious place to start.
Yeah. The I looked up the wild quote. It was socialism will be of value because it will lead to individualism. And I think if we have that clip about the nationalizing the oil industry.
Yeah, I have it ready right here.
This is a perfect example. Like, we could nationalize this stuff and pay for this stuff for families, right? And I love – first, the meta comment is I love how eager Charlie was for agreement on things here. Like, I'm not defending the pharma industry and all that stuff, right? Like, he likes to put his – I'm endlessly fascinated by that – sort of emerging dynamic, but let's play this clip about nationalizing oil.
Yeah, so we have this clip about, and I just wanted to note before that, because we can't play every clip in here, but Ben does a really great job before this clip where Charlie sort of has a cherry-picked quote. It's from the Danish, as the president or prime minister, you know, basically saying that we're not a socialist country, which Ben was prepared to, you know, to answer. And I think he answered it very well by basically saying, and tell me if I'm misrepresenting your argument, like, you know, asking the leader of like the center right party in Denmark about, you know, if the country is socialist would be like asking me or like other radical communists in the United States about, you know, how communists or what the political situation in America is like. You know, it's sort of like an absurd.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the idea. Yeah, Lars Rasmussen, I think is his name, who is the Danish prime minister, who, yeah, represents center-right party. And he has this quote, oh, there's nothing socialist about all these social programs. It's like, I don't know, maybe the socialist governments who actually implemented those programs would disagree. But also, I mean, is Lars Rasmussen, is he like the spokesman for the Danish hive mind, you know, like that, that everybody in Denmark, you know, agrees with this?
No, I thought that was great. But so here's on Norway and oil and nationalization. And I think this is a really interesting exchange here.
You know, if you look at how long socialist parties were in power in Denmark and how many of those programs came about under them. I would not say that these are societies that have achieved socialism. We can certainly talk about what that would mean to me. But I would say that these are societies where socialist parties allied with strong unions have brought about really beneficial social reforms as an effort to move farther in that direction.
So let's talk about Norway,
sure,
a country that I'm familiar with, you're familiar with. Very wealthy country.
Yeah.
Why?
Because I think the biggest reason is that they have done something that I'm sure that you wouldn't support, which is nationalize their oil industry.
You mean use fossil fuels, not keep it in the ground like Bernie Sanders would be. Bernie Sanders has tweeted, we need to keep all fossil fuels in the ground. But Norway's built a $1 trillion sovereign wealth fund after.
So would you support that?
Nationalization? No, but it's better than keeping it in the ground.
Okay.
Sure.
I mean, look, I think ultimately we probably are better off, you know, transitioning to other energy sources. But if we're going to use oil, I would much rather that oil be in the hands of the people, that it fund generous social programs like in Norway. And I often do kind of get a sense when conservatives say this. It's like, oh, well, there's really nothing socialist about it. They've just nationalized the oil industry and used the proceeds to fund all of these social programs. Well, I mean, if that's not socialist, can we at least have that not socialist thing? That sounds nice to me.
Let me clarify, is that if there is wealth to be redistributed, there must be wealth to be redistributed.
Sure.
And Norway has the advantage of having some of the most strategic oil reserves in the country. And I just pinpoint it in particular because there tends to be this anti-fossil fuel development movement.
It's something Norway and the United States have in common, is that we have a lot of oil. Now, if you want to, again, I know you've said you don't want to do this.
No, of course. I think the private ownership of minerals is a strategic advantage for the United States. But let me ask you about what I think is one of the reasons why I think the Scandinavian country's pursuit of egalitarianism.
You're muted, David.
Sorry, I actually have that clip for later because the immigration argument is not new. But that was Ben, yeah, should we be nationalizing oil?
Yeah, I mean, this is, the second he said, like, Norway wealth, I knew it was going to be, you know, that, like, some kind of gotcha about oil. And it's like, it just seems like such a simple point. It's like, okay, so we're in agreement. We should nationalize the American oil industry and use it to fund a generous welfare state. That sounds good.
Frankly, like, you see why this group, like, specializes in making, like, videos that are one way, right? Because they sort of think that the left is, like, this kind of tender group where, like, you know, if you say, like, you know, because we believe in climate change and we want to reduce our, like, oil consumption, that if you note that some countries have used nationalization of, like, natural resources for the betterment of their society, a principle that we do also, that we agree with, that we're just going to, like, explode in front of them and, you know, fall apart.
Oh, my God, it was oil, right? Which is, like, whatever.
Could you imagine how much better American society would be if instead of all of the rich oil wealth that we have in this country, instead of it just gliding the pockets of a few billionaires, ended up going to benefiting American working people? I mean, they would never do that.
We'd have transitioned off it by now.
We would be, that's for sure. Yeah. I mean, we would be living in frankly, probably something close to utopia or socialism in that kind of system. I knew
such a huge redistribution of wealth to have that happen. And again, I mean, whatever the energy resource is, like, the point of principle is I want that to be publicly owned, you know, and which none of those guys like it, whether it's, you know, like, whether it's oil, which, you know, Norway got away with, but I mean, that was what led to the coup in Iran, whether it's lithium, being nationalized. It doesn't matter. I mean, the point is, here's this huge, incredibly profitable industry. Who do we think should control it? And who do we think should have the money? And at the end, he just kind of asserts, I think he's about to change the subject to immigration, but he just kind of asserts with no explanation that it's a strategic advantage to have, like, individual rich people own the nation's oil resources.
And you see what happens in the state of Texas when you have all of these private corporations controlling our oil, is mass pollution, destruction of farmland, not to mention the fact that these guys get together and they start making demands against the government. It's just, It's a weird argument. And again, like nationalization is a good thing. Just for people who might be stumbling on it, it's like, you know, the argument even for nationalization from like a eco-socialist perspective is that that also mm-hmm. gives us the ability to democratically decide how much we're producing and what we're producing it for versus just leaving it to an anarchic system like we currently have, which just means that, you know, Shell Oil is, you know, continuing to ravage the earth while producing podcasts saying that like they understand all the problems, you know, just like fainting and acting like they understand all the problems and that they're really finally listening to activists and the public. I don't know. I'd much rather have a situation where the government could just, you know, pull the cord if we needed to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if the government is controlling the oil industry, then we can make collective democratic decisions about all of those things. Now, that said, I do want to give credit where credit's due here. It is undeniably true that in order for there to be wealth to be redistributed, there has to be wealth to be redistributed.
That's and true.
Also that Norway has some of the largest reserves of oil in the country of Norway, I'm assuming.
Yeah, unlike the United States. A very oil poor country.
Like we definitely couldn't afford to use the same.
I don't know. Yeah, it's just like maybe if we were in France or something, I could get that, but I don't know. I'm curious. Unless you had something, Matt, I wanted to sort of talk about the international stuff, but
yeah. Well, I just wanted to note a couple of things, which is like one, he peddled. In addition to peddling to the family an awful lot, he also said that won't work because of immigrants quite an awful lot. Yeah. That seems to be mm-hmm. a recurring theme, but also just generally missing the principle, just like in that clip. And we don't have this clip, but there's another section where he's like, what if you could give workers a tax cut and it wouldn't affect the budget at all, actually. And he was surprised you would take that, like as if you just want to tax workers because you like the government to have money, as this, you know, like not really understanding the principle of where like somebody from the genuine left would care about like which dollars go where.
No, exactly. Like taxes on billionaires might actually serve an independent function because,
right,
you know, that reduces their political power and all that stuff. But like taxes on workers are not an end in themselves. I don't want to actually eliminate the FICA tax like we say, because I know that the effect of that, you know, I know where the money would be taken out on the other end, right? Let's put it that way.
Which is Social Security and Medicare.
Yeah, exactly. But like, once I kind of said that, he was like, okay, but hypothetically, let's say that absolutely nothing was going to be cut. I was like, well, okay, that hypothetical, sure, you know, like, but it's like, I don't know what that's supposed to prove, you know, like that's a little bit like saying, like, if you, you know, hey, if you could get a lifetime supply of your favorite whiskey and you were never going to be charged with it and nothing bad was going to happen to you as a result, do you want it? It's like, sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's money in workers' pockets that frankly, like, I mean, like you said, like, I'd rather that money comes from the capitalists than any sort of government.
Right, exactly.
And if you say like there's some sort of weird thing where it can't be used for any new programs if you do have that tax. But like, yeah, get all. I would have the very opposite of what Charlie wants, which is a flat tax, which is like the backwards L tax, where you start at the highest rate, just have it, just take all that money until everyone is nice and even.
Exactly. I mean, like you, if you can fund all of the. You know, the social services that are actually, you know, going to benefit. I mean, really, actually, we could talk about how Social Security and Medicare are funded, and I agree, there are much better ways to do it. That would be more progressive, you know. But like, to the extent that you can tax workers, it's only because that's stuff that's going to lead to services, the loss of which would hurt them more than the tax does.
Well, I mean, it's a similar thing when we were sort of arguing against Andrew Yang's UBI, right? It's like, I'm very happy for people to be getting extra money.
Sure.
You know, but right. if it is also being, you know, used to sort of argue for more cuts to our already meager social safety net, absolutely not. I wanted to sort of, maybe this is just maybe something of interest to me, because I've been reading a lot of Leo Panish again and sort of getting into like thinking about socialist transformation, talking about these Scandinavian countries, because I would like to hear what both of y'all think about this, because Ben, I think you do a really great job in this debate, and it's almost always how these debates go, is they want to find the country that we think is the good socialist country, and then they want to find a problem in it and sort of or something that contradicts the statement that we have. And actually, maybe before we get into the point that I wanted to make, I'm curious about how you feel about this as somebody, you know, who's studies logic and thinks about debate. You know, and I think you show in that debate a great way of doing it, but I'm just curious how you go into those conversations, because there's a part of me that always just wants to be like, oh, whenever they start talking about Norway or Denmark or something like that, said like, yeah, I mean, I like things like, you know, healthcare and all this kind of stuff, but by no means is this like the end goal social society, mm-hmm. and I don't want to get pigeonholed. But I think you did a good job at sort of finding a way to balance saying, hey, some of these things work, but also you're not going to make me own all of, you know, Norwegian society. I don't know. How do you think about like dealing with somebody using an example that you might not want to be using and trying to find a way to flip that on them?
Yeah. I mean, I think actually when he started asking me about which countries I'd point to, which is what happened just before that, you know, he mm-hmm. was like, oh, what are countries and, you know, in the world, you know, you'd point to that embody, you know, what our socialist, I think is how he put it, but like that was the idea. And so, you know, it says, well, look, there are no countries in the world where I've got everything mm-hmm. that I want. Right. You know, but the Nordics, you know, have implemented a lot of short-term reforms that I do want. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but I did front load before I think we even threw back to him, look, these are complicated societies. Right-wing parties sometimes win elections, and they mm-hmm. they do things that I don't like. The point is not that everything that exists in any Nordic country is good, and, you know, and everything that doesn't, you know, is bad. The point is the reason to talk about the Nordics is that these are thriving economies, which shows that it's not going to lead to like economic catastrophe to mm-hmm. do this program. Where a lot of the things that we want have been successfully beta tested. You know, a lot of these sort of expansive social democratic policies that take certain parts of the economy outside of the market and provide for certain human needs that certainly aren't provided for in the United States. But actually, I thought in some ways that the funniest thing about that is that in the very beginning of the debate, like in the opening statement, mm-hmm. I said, we could talk about what I would consider, you know, to, you know, my idea of utopia in contrast to yours, but, you know, we could do that later if you want, but let's talk about the baby steps in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And then like when he was queuing me up for the Norway thing, so he could do all of his gotchas about things in Norway that I would like, or that he didn't think I'd like, I said, we saw in that clip, look, these are clearly not fully socialist societies. That's not the reason that I'm bringing them up. Mm-hmm. But then later on, you know, I think it might have been in the second half, he said, well, I feel like you're cloaking your radicalism by talking about, you know, basically these incredibly popular policies like minimum wage and healthcare. I was like, I am. I mean, it kind of seems like I'm the one who keeps bringing it up that I actually do have more radical long-term goals than just being like Norway.
Mm-hmm. No, I think exactly. And like, I don't know, it's just like, I mean, we've done this debate on this show. We played a debate between Yaron Brook and Leo Panitch on like socialism, right? And there's this kind of fixation like, well, this is a socialist policy and this is not a socialist policy, right? Which is, I just think is something that like, while we have to go out and like fight people on their own terms and in terms that they understand and not make things seem so complicated that we're avoiding questions, we also need to be careful, I think, not to fall into the trap of thinking that like certain policies are necessarily socialist. Like, let me give you an example of this, because this is something that I thought was an interesting point. I can't remember if it was in regards to Norway or Finland, or I can't remember what exactly a Nordic country was talking about. He was talking about, I believe it was Norway, that doesn't have a minimum wage, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, sort of like that's like, you know, such a bad thing. But people need to remember that, like, we advocate for a minimum wage in the United States because class power is so lopsided against working people that we actually have to set just like a minimally allowed legal standard for what you can pay a worker, right? It's not something like you don't need a minimum wage in a situation where you're able to sort of break the power of capital. And certainly if you were living in a socialist society where you've completely broken the power of capital, you wouldn't need one at all, right? But a minimum wage is like something that if you're looking at the board, if you're looking at class power in society and saying, okay, we might not be able to get all the things that we want, but hey, we could prevent them from paying people, you know, starvation wages, you put that in place, right? And in the United States, again, we're advocating for an increase in the minimum wage because we are in that kind of weakened position. But it's not that necessarily like in and of itself, like the minimum wage is like the true heart beating heart of socialism. It's a legal power that we can find, you know, I don't know, to sort of like cement some victories for ourselves to make sure that things can't be pulled back. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's just like, these are like some of the bigger things that I'm thinking that like we need to start being prepared to wrestle with when we're engaging with the public and when we're engaging with right wingers, be prepared to like push back against their nonsense, but also not making the mistake ourselves that when Kirk says, for example, a country doesn't have the minimum wage, we're like, oh no, you know, that means that it's like a bad country, right? It actually means that things are stronger there for working people than they are in the United States.
Yeah, which this actually did come up in the debate that he said, well, you know, Ned Denmark doesn't have a minimum wage. You know, surely this is the first time I've ever heard that, right? You know, like that's not a point right wingers love to bring up. And it's like, yeah, but you have to say the other half that it's not that they don't have a minimum wage. So the market, you know, it's just like whatever the market can bear, you know, like whatever, you know, like individual workers are desperate enough to work for is what you can pay them. It's that they have incredibly strong labor unions that negotiate agreements for entire sectors of the economy. And that, you know, the wage floor is enforced that way.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. I think and I think you did a great job in the debate on that. I mean, well, should we go to the immigration clip or should we go straight ahead to the Bezos? What do you think, Matt?
It's up to you. I mean, I'm eager for the Bezos clip, but if you want to immigration, I mean, yeah, we can do immigration if you guys.
Yeah, let's do immigration just because
they bring it up a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like I think given Charlie Kirk's particular flavor, like the particular flavor of reactionary that he is, the immigration thing is important.
Yeah.
Here we go. So I'm going to mute y'all.
Oh, yeah, gotcha.
Now, this has changed in recent years because of a lot of the Syrian refugee crisis and more kind of left-wing governments taking over Sweden in particular. But Norway, for example, takes in about 70 immigrants a day, even with their more relaxed policies. America, much bigger country, albeit, 2,740 legal immigrants, about 5,000 if you include the people going across the southern border. Do you... As being a Democrat socialist, do you support closed borders and strict immigration?
No, I don't. And I'll tell you why. So two reasons. One is that I think that, you know, all of the economic data that I've seen says that having more immigrants actually increases the amount of wealth that society has to go around. And the second is I would ask what the alternatives are. Right. So, you know, we can do, you know, like those families that, you know, that you talk about, right? You know, we can, do things like separating families. We can do things like raiding, you know, churches, you know, to drag out immigrants. But I think we would really, really, really have to step up that, like, by like a factor of 100 to actually get rid of all the undocumented immigrants in the country. Whereas I think a much better solution, if what you're worried about is, hey, here are people coming in who, yeah, they definitely, you know, contribute to economic growth, but here are people coming in who are willing to work for low wages or whatever. I think a much better solution to that problem is for those people to have a pathway to citizenship so that they're not afraid to do things like join unions, or they're not afraid to do things like, you know, take their employers to court when they violate labor laws. I think that's a much better solution to that problem than the sort of heavy-handed, you know, police state kinds of tactics, which I think would be the only way that you're actually going to resolve the status quo in the other direction.
And then he goes on to pull a Bernie quote completely out of context. But again, I think that this was a good, you know, response here, Ben, because you're hitting at the unfreedom aspect of these kind of policies, right? Is that, you know, this is actually used to restrict people's freedom. And if this is your most holy principle of government, you know, you're not doing a great job of upholding it as long as you allow people to sort of create these little fiefdoms and ignore even basic American labor law that we've decided that we want to have in our country. Oh, sorry, Ben, you are muted. I got
there
you.
There we go. Yeah. Look, Charlie, like, he loves this point for the same reason that Tucker Carlson loves it, you know, for the same reason that, you know, whoever, Josh Hawley, all of them do, because it lets them posture as if they actually give a shit about native-born American workers, which obviously is not the case. You know, like, and the context shift is just amazing.
Oh, no.
Oh, Lord, we lost Ben. We'll see if we can get him back on. Here he is, yeah. You're back, Ben.
Okay. In every other context where we're contemplating state action to help working class people, all of these guys, despite their alleged populism, are going to say, no, we can't do that. Raising the minimum wage, that's too interventionist, that's too, you know, administrative state, you know, we can't give everybody health care, the same problem, you know. We want a state that's like way too small for that, but like exactly large enough to literally like tear young children away from the arms of their mothers and, you know, put them in concentration camps, right? Just that size, right? And it's just amazing because in context like the immigration thing, where they're trying to pit one group of workers against another group of workers, you know, they care, they say they care about one of those two groups. But in all these other contexts, they don't. When, like, actually, even from the perspective of what are you going to do for American workers, I mean, either we're going to, like, escalate you know, let's be honest about this, Obama, Trump, you know, now Biden, you know, war against immigrants. We're going to escalate it to, like, Kristallnacht levels, or you have to have some way for, you know, for those workers to be comfortable taking the kind of avenues to protect their livelihoods, to be able to negotiate for higher wages than Americans would.
What do you guys make just generally to the right wing response to this as like, we do have a labor shortage in this country and they're still completely like freaking out about the idea that people might come here and take our jobs?
I mean, I think that the rhetorical point there is very simple. I mean, they're all over the place and there's not a lot of truth in their position. I would think, you know, argue though, like as Bernie Sanders has been very principled and correct on that, you know, we need to be fighting against this carceral state and like the brutality of our border and abolishing ICE and all of those things. But like an unrestricted move of like and flow of like labor into the United States is a tactic to you that like capitalists do promote. As Bernie Sanders said very notably, like that's a Koch brothers proposal, open borders, right? You know, these are things that like we have to be able to, I don't know, it's just like understand like why there's a certain kind of immigration that like these massive corporations try to promote in the United States. And remember, this is not an argument against immigration. It's against the kind of immigration, as Ben was noting earlier, that is trying to bring in people who are afraid for their ability to stay in the society. Exactly. They're afraid that they're going to face abuse, right? And like, just under, yeah, I don't know, like not falling for the bait of just because the right wing is sort of like like kicking their heels about people coming into this country while all of their donors are benefiting.
Yeah, I actually think there is kind of a larger point here that goes beyond the immigration issue, which is that oftentimes because we live in this ridiculous neoliberal hellscape where the working class has almost no political power at all, the kinds of things that people are arguing about in mainstream politics are often arguments that where like both sides are pretty bad, you know, for workers, that, you know, that, that like maybe we're talking about a status quo that's awful versus a way of making it like 5% worse. But I think that we make a real mistake as leftists if our intervention in those debates is to focus too much on, well, what you want is 5% worse, so it sounds like we're fine with the status quo. And I think this comes up all the time. I mean, look at the issue, like the stuff that's been going on in like Los Angeles, you know, all the raids on homeless encampments. I think that it's really important, actually, as leftists to say, look, obviously the worst thing that can happen is this kind of police state authoritarian crackdown and these desperate people sleeping in the park. But we also need to be really clear that a close second worst thing that could happen is just allowing the continuation of the status quo where desperate people are sleeping in the park, where they're extremely vulnerable to social predation of all kinds and unscrupulous drug dealers and much worse, right? You know, violence, you know, and that like saying oh, everything's fine as long as the encampments are still there, which is essentially the position of a lot of liberals. Mm-hmm. Like that itself is really callous towards those people. And like, what we need is a society is to provide these people with like real dignified, normal, permanent housing. Not like they, oh, you know, you have a, you know, a shelter where, you know, you have to leave it between this hour and that hour, or you can't bring your pets, and, you know, you can only bring two bags of your possessions, which, yeah, no wonder a lot of people end up sleeping in the park rather than doing that. But, like, just saying, looking at that situation and saying, oh, this is fine, is really a gift to the right-wingers who want the crackdowns.
No, I just wanted to note on this that, like, this is something that like people like Tyler Cowen, right, who is hardcore libertarian professor at George Mason. He writes in his book that like what the United States needs to be doing is allowing for there to be shanty towns essentially in the middle of the cities, and for us to get rid of any kind of regulations on those kind of spaces, which is, I think, an extremely dystopian view. Now, yeah, obviously,
of course, and most ordinary people are, you know, like who are, you know, maybe workers, but they're not at that level of desperation. You know, like so many people will hear that and be like, wait a second. So you want to just continue this forever, that like I can't take my kids to the park because there's somebody sleeping there. Maybe there's this, you know, there's crime and drugs there, which really does happen. Right. I mean, that's not like something that they made up. You know, they have like, you want that? No, maybe I actually do sympathize with the police state authoritarianism. It's the same thing on the immigration issue. If you're just defending the, these various ways of cracking down on undocumented immigrants make things worse, which is certainly true. Then, you know, it's very easy for the Charlie Kirks and Josh Howleys and Tucker Carlsons of the world to say, oh, see, you're actually on the side of the corporations, that you want these people to continue to exist in this gray zone where everybody knows they're there, but it's not exactly legal. And in that, you know, that zone where they could be hyper exploited and that could be used to undermine other workers' wages.
No, it's all right. I mean, I just want to note very, like, to be very clear on, like, especially on the homeless issue, right? The solution is to be fighting for public housing,
exactly,
on a mass scale, while at the same time opposing efforts by the right wing to increase like policing and terror against homeless communities, right? This is literally like, you know, just trying to be a little bit more dialectical though, and not like making the mistake, because the fact is that liberals and neoliberals, especially, will love to sit on their hands on these kind of public demands that we do something different, or, you know, so like, yeah, it's like, so when you see like people saying like, okay, well, we don't want the police to, you know, harass folks, you know, the cities will be like, okay, we'll get rid of it, but we're not going to like fund public housing or something like that. And our job as socialists is to make that second demand that like, hey, the status quo is not acceptable either way that you're going to take it, right? To just like, you know, to increase policing against folks, or to just basically do nothing for people who are, you know, without homes and similar kind of questions with immigration. Yeah, I think, yeah, these are like where we have a really specific role in the public that I think is really important when these kind of big flashpoint debates are happening, where we have a very different vision that's sort of addressing all of these problems on a macro level, instead of sort of just getting bogged down in like, okay, what gradient of like terror do we want to like, you know, put upon people?
Yeah. And it's also, I think your point was also important, the right one, about like how this actually serves bosses now, the current system, which is that when you have a class of people that are illegal, then, and you also have a state agency of sort of like cops that you can call in case those people start acting up. Like, imagine, look at all the labor activity we have going on right now. Imagine how many places are skirting by because if things got a line, they could just call ICE on their labor force.
I've worked at places where that threat has been made to people.
Yeah.
I'm just like, I've worked at restaurants where that has been very clearly, hinted at for people that like, you know, I think I have some suspicions about your immigration status. Oh, you're complaining about not coming in this Saturday. You know, you don't want to come in this Saturday, et cetera, et cetera. It'd be a shame if I picked up the phone, you know? Yeah. I mean,
sorry, and none of those bosses are getting locked up.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. Yeah, no, I think I think that hits it really well. I mean, I want to get to this Bezos thing a little bit, and then we can zoom out in the last couple of minutes, because we did promise that we're going to grill you on platforming Charlie Kirk. So we have to make sure that we're not being cowards on that level. But let me pull this last bit, because this was interesting. I mean, he opens up the debate by noting how much you guys agree on, your hatred of Jeff Bezos. What was it? Hunter Biden. I can't remember the other one.
I think the things that we're supposed to agree on were Jeff Bezos is bad, although my actual point was that Jeff Bezos' existence is a symptom of a despicable economic system. That's why I brought up Jeff Bezos to begin, that Hunter Biden is bad, and would that like hospitals should be required to like publicly list their prices, which I said, yeah, sure, that's good, but also they shouldn't have prices. Yeah.
So this is it, and this is sort of towards the end of the debate. This isn't the post game, but the bonus bit of the debate, which I noticed that Ben was starting to get a little. You're starting to get ready to get to some of these points that had seemed to be every time, you were close to really hitting him on like healthcare and like these kind of like really big points. He was always moving it somewhere else. So this is when I felt like you were really trying to pin him down on some of these big claims he was making.
Okay, so here's what I wanted to ask, real quick. Sure. I promise. So we established earlier how much we both liked Jeff Bezos.
Yes.
Dislike best Jeff Bezos.
Are you
going
to ask me, should I raise his taxes?
Well, because this is why I'm curious about
it. Because I
saw in 2019.
Yes, with Kyle Kalinske.
Yeah, and he asked you, would you be willing to raise Jeff Bezos' taxes by like 1% to provide housing for every single homeless veteran? And your response at that time was that you'd hope he'd do it voluntarily. And I think at this point we've established that's not going to happen. He'd prefer to buy a spaceship. So
that's probably true. So if you put a gun to my head, would I raise his taxes? I mean, I guess if I was a representative, I guess, yes.
That's good.
For other reasons.
This is progress. I'm so proud of you, Charlie.
Let me tell you, I said, I guess conditionally, if all of a sudden there would be a comparable piece of legislation alongside of it that would actually value and prioritize things I cared about. If it was just to raise his taxes to go into the current albatross pit of the administrative state, I'd rather have him buy spaceships than give money to Fauci.
But if it was earmarked for a housing for homeless veterans, and you would say yes.
The
now,
answer is yes, because I think Jeff Bezos,
this is such good progress.
But let me tell you why. Let me clarify why. Sure. Jeff Bezos games your favorite department, the Postal Service. He games the corporate tax loophole system. Yeah. Jeff Bezos has a total disregard for what I consider to be the American way of life. And he has this weird fascination of going into orbit. And guess what? I hope he stays there.
Okay. Well, I congratulate you on this progress.
Well, I mean, you could call it progress. You could also call it a commitment to prudence.
Okay, no, but
it's that Greek word, prudentia, which is looking at things as they are, and it's a non.
Next level.
Yeah, it spends like a minute, like arguing with himself about whether there is like some hypothetical, or maybe he'd be willing to agree to raise Jeff Bezos' taxes by 1% to house every homeless veteran.
Only for veterans housing, but like, isn't that an interventionist state? Like, I'm just concerned about the natural law implications of all this.
No, I mean, the thing is like, if you start giving veterans free health care and free housing, I mean, they're not really going to be as interested in being cogs in the machine of capitalism, Kirk. So I don't know if this is a good solution to your...
hammocks. I just want to say real quickly, like, all those free houses should have hammocks in it. But anyway, go on, continue, Ben.
No, absolutely. The veterans should also be given hammocks. But yeah, you know, they've earned it. No, I think this is actually not... the most astonishing concession that he made in the debate, the really bizarre one, and it went by in like 2 seconds, like you could blink and miss it, is in the like post game kind of half, we were arguing about like hard work and whether people should be rewarded for hard work and whether you should have to work for the things that you get. And I said, well, okay. I mean, if your principle is that nobody should get anything they didn't work for, then here are 2 things you should hate: stock ownership and inheritance. Mm-hmm. And he actually said, well, maybe you could convince me on stock ownership. And he then started arguing with me about inheritance, but it's like, wait, like, really? Like, you're willing to give up on stock ownership?
That's a big one, man. I mean, that's
before
the end
inheritance
of this system. I mean... Yeah, I mean, that's essentially how, that's like all of the innovations in American capitalism at this point are financial innovations. Is finding ways to sort of stick yourself into already existing like economic activity. So breaking down that dynamic, I mean, Charlie Kirk is sort of coming for the engine of the beast, right? He's like, he's coming to sort of end that whole system. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, because I wanted to sort of ask briefly at the end a bit about the philosophy, because the next section, I don't have it clipped up, but there's a whole thing on Euthyphro, which I found to be very, very interesting. But before that, I want to ask you, Ben, I was texting you this the other day. It's like, when did this like Hegel thing start? Because I mean, what he called, you mentioned earlier, but in the middle of the debate, he calls Woodrow Wilson a Hegelian.
Yes, yes, he does. And there's actually a really weird point pretty early in the debate where I don't even remember what it was that I said that he responded this way to. It certainly had nothing to do with Hegel. And he said, oh, well, I guess we're all Hegelians now. I was like, what? Well,
can I ask you just for the record, Ben, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but are you a Hegelian?
No, I'm not.
The thing is, like, look, I mean, the answer is very simple. It's like they think that it makes it seem like they know like the dark secret and like the engine of like Marxism, right?
Well, this
the same thing as when they say Das Kapital, right?
Yeah. Genetic fallacy a little bit too, yeah.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like I actually think so. First of all, my answer to the when did they get obsessed with Hegel is that I blame James Lindsay.
Yeah,
I think that he did this, but
right.
But
which, by the way, sorry for like, it's the most like on brand James Lindsay thing. Cause if anyone spends any time in a philosophy department, and I know there's some people who listen to this who are really into Hegel, but like very classic things, like the most annoying guy in the room is like obsessed with Hegel. Right. Yeah. And like James Lindsay being like the most annoying, like kind of right wing propagandist being obsessed with Hegel is very on brand too.
But the weird thing is like, and what's kind of touching about this is, look, Charlie became a conservative propagandist instead of going to college. So he's a little bit autodidact about this stuff. And like, I kind of, that was the part that was kind of touching to me. Like he wanted to talk to you about this stuff because I don't think he gets a lot of chance to do it. But when you talk about Marx, like I remember when I was taught Marx in undergrad, it was the German ideology, and we got that like sort of Hegelian young, because the class was Hegel, Marx, and Nietzsche. And so we got like the Hegel, like young Hegelian sort of like thing. But the whole point was like, he's not a Hegelian. He's splitting with Hegel in a very severe sense.
Yeah, well, that was the funny thing about that part of the debate, because he had... Like he asked me, like kind of at the beginning of the post game, what do you think about Marx? And one of the things that I said, you know, it's like, look, I'm not going to dogmatically say that Marx got every single thing right, or there's nothing that you can revise 150 years later, and you know, whatever. But like, you know, overall, yeah, you know, I think his theory of history is mostly right. And he jumped on that, and he said, and I quote, "I'm happy to argue about Hegelian dialectics and the phenomenology of spirit," which I want to just say, like. I kind of think, well, I'd be fascinated to see what that would look like, but then, you know, and he was like, oh, but that's basically it, right? That's basically Marx's theory of history is Hegel. And I said, like, what I think is the least, like maybe the least interesting thing you could possibly say about this, which is no. and he starts saying, oh, but you know, Marx was like, he said the head of the young Hegelians. I'm not quite sure what he means by that, but whatever, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, but it's like, and I was like, yeah, he started out as a young Hegelian, but then he criticizes Hegel's theory of history in favor of what is structurally, you know, the similar, but is in substance exactly the opposite, which is a materialist theory of history.
Yeah.
And it was just so weird. Cause like, I would think that would be on the Wikipedia page for Marx.
That's page one.
Oh, for sure, man. I mean, like there's like even famous lines about like Louis Althusser, like one of like the last great, like, you know, real hardcore Marxists, like, you know, sit within Marxism and don't move from out of it. Like says about Marx and Hegel's like Marx takes Hegel and like puts it back on its feet.
Yeah,
right. Like Hegel is just completely upside down about everything. I don't know. I mean, not to get, I know for some, we might lose some people with too much of this stuff, but like, it is really fascinating. If you've spent any time, dealing with like, frankly, not even Marxism, but like the history of ideas, right? And philosophy,
yeah, exactly.
To sit here and not get that, like, I don't know. Yes. Well, Marx sort of like as were a lot of young German idealists, right? Remember also, like, Marx goes from this movement, from like German idealism into what we call like materialism, right? Radically different philosophies.
No, exactly. And as Matt says about the German ideology, I mean, quite a bit of Marx's early work is written in opposition to Hegelianism, because of course that's what he's breaking from. That's what he's reacting to. And none of this means, like, you know, if you're a Marxist, you shouldn't like read Hegel or find Hegel interested. It's it's just that, like, it's just as a matter of fact, right? I mean, at the end of the day, views of these two guys about what the motor force of history is could not be more different.
Right.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's next level stuff. Well, we got a couple minutes, if that's all right, Ben. I just wanted to ask you as like a sort of closing segment.
Yeah.
You do these debates. You engage with right wingers from time to time. You've even written pieces in, you know, magazines. I mean, this was a while ago, but like Quillette, right? When a lot of people were, you know, treating that. I mean, I feel like they've had a little bit of a fall from grace, but maybe I just haven't been paying attention. You know, you engage with our opponents. Some people think that that's good, right, and noble. There are a lot of folks out there who think that. I mean, you know, that this is, I didn't see anyone
how could you
typically about Kirk, but like platforming or drawing attention to somebody like Charlie Kirk.
I did get a little bit of it over Kirk. There's the editor of, I think, something called Spectre Journal who went after.
I know that journal, actually.
Yeah, who went after me about like platforming Charlie Kirk.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. I think that you can't platform somebody on their own show. But.
Well, no, not to even mention, like, okay. Charlie Kirk is somebody, I mean, I guarantee you that if you just walk out into the street and ask people who's Charlie Kirk, it's not going to take you that long to find somebody who knows who he is. If you go out into the street and ask them who's Ben Burgess, right, it'll take a lot longer. I mean, unless maybe certain parts of Brooklyn or Silver Lake will be a little shorter, but, like, you know, other than that, right, you know, it's going to be a much longer process. Charlie Kirk spoke at the last Republican National Convention.
Yeah.
I don't think he's waiting for me to give him his big break.
Okay, so I mean, I think that that's a very fair point, you know, specific, you know, just on like fame, but like on the point of engaging with right wingers, treating it as if these debates that we're having, I mean, like, you know, he didn't say anything altogether horrific, but the implication, for example, about immigration, the implication there about all this stuff is like, you know, sort of entry level, like white supremacist stuff, right? The idea is that like by engaging with them, we treat these like ideas as if they're legitimate political perspectives rather than things that should be cast aside. I know we talk about this all the time, you know, behind the scenes. Could you just, you know, for folks who are on the fence about this, why is it worthwhile engaging with people who hold abhorrent right-wing views in public ways like this?
Yeah. So let me just say one thing real specifically about Charlie Kirk, and then more generally about the reason why I think that it's a good thing for leftists to go into, you know, into centrist or right-wing spaces in order to argue against their ideas. So on Charlie Kirk, you know, I basically wanted to do two things here. The objectively much less important one, but it means something to me, is because I remember that segment that you guys did. I wasn't on it, you know, but like that segment you guys did on TMBS a long time ago, where the two of you and Michael are making fun of Charlie Kirk for like talking about Hegel and talking about Plato.
And so,
you know, I kind of wanted to, you know, to stick a couple pins in that balloon. But and I think that the Plato part of this is interesting, right? Let's just say that. But the much more important thing is I wanted to talk to anybody in Charlie Kirk's audience who takes this populist branding seriously and to try to explain why it's just total nonsense. The guy is a complete servant of the 1% politically. Like, he might say he hates Jeff Bezos, but he certainly doesn't hate you know, a system that allows for somebody to work, like, literally like work people to the point where they have this crazy high injury rate and then like use the money that he makes from them to buy himself a spaceship. And he was ambivalent about whether he even raises taxes. So I wanted to kind of expose that to anybody who's in his audience who takes that seriously. And And by the way, I will say, looking at the comments on Charlie's channel, there's, you know, a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people have a lot to say, you know, about my, you know, about my appearance and, you know, this and that, and the other thing, but like, not a lot of, oh, remember when Charlie really got him on X, right? Like, if anything, like by far the most common negative comment was that I didn't let him talk enough on his own show.
I mean, frankly, I mean, I won't, you know, make you embarrass yourself by complimenting yourself too much, but if go, people should go read the comments. I mean, they are very interesting to see a lot of people saying like, well, I disagreed with him on all of these things, but like on this point, like, oh, he made a good point about this, this and that. Like, that is worthwhile. And I'm sorry, there's a reason why they're, the right wing is investing money into doing these kind of outlets.
Debate shows. Candace Owens is doing the same thing.
Yeah, well, Candace, my DMs are open. Although really, really, I want Jason Miles to take that one. But in any case, in this particular case, those are the goals. But the broader point is this: I think oftentimes people who raise these platforming worries or whatever, even aside from the fact that the arithmetic is not what it would have to be for it to make any sense, that, you know, I'm going on his platform, which is vastly larger than any of our platforms. But I would love to live in a world where the arithmetic worked out such that this was like something we really had to agonize about, you know, whether we were going to legitimize these people by, you know, by talking to them. But really, the idea that, they're getting some kind of legitimacy from us, right? That like people are going to say, ooh, well, I don't know. I mean, that's, you know, that Marxist podcaster, you know, like talk to him.
Atheist, so he must be, man.
Yeah. Yes. Marxist atheist professor is how he labeled the video.
Trifecta, the three worst things you can be.
Yeah. All of the elements of that are correct, but it's somehow it feels a little bit like it might as well be Charlie Kirk versus rootless cosmopolitan Ben Burgess. But, in any case, like the, you know, I don't think the legitimizing worry makes sense. In fact, I think there's a little bit of a contradiction, because oftentimes the same people who raise the legitimizing worry will also say, well, there's no point to debates because nobody's ever convinced. So it's like, okay, so nobody's ever moved by anything they hear in debate, but also our audience will like them better because we debated, you know, which is it, right? I mean, like, they're going to convince all of the leftists who watch like GTA or Left Reckoning. Like, first of all, arrogant. I mean, maybe I'm just arrogant here, but no, I don't think so. I don't think Charlie Kirk's or any of these people are going to get a lot of converts out of that. But like, also, if nobody's influenced by anything they hear in the debate, what are you worried about? Now, since I think that people can be influenced by it, and I mean, like, clearly they can be. Anybody who does this regularly will get those testimonials. Right. We could argue about how often, but don't get me wrong. Right. If your political strategy solely consists of doing debates, that'd be a terrible political strategy. Yeah. And we can even say there are other things that should be much bigger components of that strategy. And I don't disagree. You know, like the joke I made on my show was like, look, if I fell off one end of a lifeboat and a really good union organizer fell off the other end, I wouldn't blame you, right, for swimming out to save the union organizer. Because, like, you know, as a matter of priorities, sure. But if some of us are going to do things like do media, then it seems to me that one of the best things we can do is do stuff like this, because we live in a world where traditional media has just been shattered.
Yep.
And everybody can curate their own media diet as they want. So the effect of that is that whether we're talking, I mean, I don't know the Quillette would print something that I sent them now, but like, you know, whether we're talking about those forays back in 2019, where sure, I'm going to the Bad People magazine, but I'm going to the Bad People magazine to argue that they're wrong.
Yeah.
Or this with Kirk. Either way, doing stuff like that is your only chance to talk to somebody else's audience. If you don't talk to them there, they're not going to find you at Jacobin.
I'm sorry, I've seen it all around me. There, especially, like, I think that there is a kind of, I don't know, I don't want to fix out on this too much, but there's a kind of mentality that some folks have about how many people are moved by this kind of new media content. I don't want to sit here and pat ourselves on the back too much, but I have seen the opposite happen. You know, I come from poor working class America, and a lot of my friends did not go to school. And there is a deep desire that people have to be educated, and people use these platforms to educate themselves mm-hmm. on things. That's why people are interested when we do conversations about philosophers, etc., right? Because people want to learn about this. And you know who's waiting there more often than not to instruct them? It's not the left. It's right. these powerful right-wing machines. So finding ways, even if it's after the fact, even if people have sort of been scooped up by those, you know, machines that they've created out there, finding off ramps for them, I think, can be extremely, extremely beneficial. As somebody who was like a little, you know, annoying ass right winger when I was a teenager, who became a Marxist, I think that is something, and it's a fight that's worth happening, and like you can really bring people, and you can move them quickly too.
I mean, speaking of atheism, I remember being like a 9 or 10 year old Catholic in North Dakota. Nobody in my circle ever really was an atheist, but I saw an atheist get interviewed about some sort of like 10 commandments on the city a courthouse sort of like deal, and at first it angered me, but it stuck with me, and like by the time I was 13 it got in my head and got me out of religion. And like that wasn't that I usually think like changes of mind are social, but at least in my case that was purely a media thing.
Which happens all the time. I mean, people and I think part of the I think there are just real quick, like two reasons why people end up having the idea that this stuff never works in that way. One is that they're making this jump from, are Charlie Kirk's most hardcore fans going to like be influenced mm-hmm. by anything you say? Well, of course not. Right? That's not the question. Right. They'll even be like, oh, but you know, you're not going to, why argue with somebody who's argued in bad faith? Because the point is not that you're trying to convince him, right? The point is you're trying to convince anybody who's convincible in the audience, which means people who might be a little bit sympathetic, but you know, they're certainly giving him a hearing. They're not necessarily married to it yet, or people who maybe even used to be hardcore fans, but for whatever reason, for a thousand reasons, they might be at right now. You catch them at a point in their life where they're open to something different. And what Matt is describing, I think, goes to the other thing, which is that people will say, well, look, nobody is convinced, because what they really mean by convinced is that, like, right there in the room, mm-hmm. you're like, oh, shit, you're right. They, got me, right? I'm a socialist now, or, you know, I'm whatever now, right? Like, and of course, that's not how persuasion works. The way persuasion mm-hmm. works is the way that Matt just said, that, like, oftentimes your initial reaction might be irritation, but then, like, it kind of starts working on you, and, you know, you're like, maybe, yeah, hold on, right? And then, like, you know, later, like, it could be like, you know, by the time there's a little bit less ego invested in it, right? Like, so, you know, gradually you start to think about more when people are persuaded. And of course, it's not that most people are going to be persuaded, but if we're in the persuasion business, which I don't know why we're doing media if we're not trying to persuade people of things, right? That's how realistically it's going to work.
Yeah. And I would say the same thing of the Anna Kasparian and Ben Shapiro debate, which I thought, like, the calculus that, like, you can platform Ben Shapiro, a guy who is the top of Facebook all the time and literally invited by a chamber of commerce. Like, more people are mm-hmm. going to watch that debate online than were in that arena. And sure. like, it's good to have somebody there giving good counterexamples.
I was just going to say, the thing I particularly loved, you know, just parenthetically about Anna's debate with Ben Shapiro is, and this made me very proud about whatever small role that I might have played in this evolution and the much larger one that, you know, that Michael certainly played and Jacobin or whatever. But like, that one of the first things she said is, you know, we should be focusing on redistribution of resources, not manufacturing culture war nonsense. And that actually put Ben Shapiro in the position where he had to say it. He did say this in the debate. Well, I take exception to say it's all manufactured nonsense. So it's like, make mm-hmm. him be the guy who says, this is great. We should absolutely be doing never ending 24/7 culture war. That's going to be a real winner, you know, with most people.
Yeah,
yep, exactly.
I think that's phenomenal. Well, for people who are unfamiliar, I'm sure most people are familiar with the great Ben Burgess. Check out his show, Give Them an Argument, and his upcoming book. Could you give people a quick tease about the Hitchens book? We're going to have you on for sure comes out.
Yeah, so it's called Christopher Hitchens, What He Got Right, How He Went Wrong, and Why He Still Matters. And Hitchens, this is actually something that I started thinking about because on TMBS in the last phase, we were doing all of these throwback clips. Mm-hmm. And that's a well that we kept going back to was the Hitchens clips. And I'll, you know, I also, you know, I mean, whatever I like, if you've been out drinking with me, you've probably had a Hitchens conversation at some point, right? Yeah. You know, but like, that really got me thinking about this stuff. And basically what I want to do, I've had that conversation with David numerous times, but, in basically what I wanted to do in this book was a couple things, which, is one is just to kind of have a more balanced portrayal that you get either for the super fans, right. Mm-hmm. Or from people who just kind of want to denounce him because, you know, sometimes for good reasons even, right, to denounce him. But then I also wanted to say, look, there's this whole body of work from 1971, which is the first time there's a book with Christopher Hitchens' name on the cover. Fun fact, that book was a collection of essays by Marx and Engels of the Paris Commune, introduction by Christopher Hitchens, through 2001, when he publishes Letters to Young Contrarian, which is really where he's starting to slip away from that, you know, socialist position. In those 30 years, he put out this body of work that I actually, like, I want to introduce this audience of young socialists who might not be familiar with it to it, who might only know him from the, you know, new atheism and neoconservative foreign policy positions period of his life. And then the last thing is that I want to explore, like, okay, as somebody who was doing really good work for a long time, but who clearly did take a disastrously long turn at the end, like, let's try to think a little bit harder about how that happened.
No, I'm really looking forward to reading the book. I've always enjoyed our conversations on that. I mean, I will say, you know, and we're going to talk about this in depth later, but like, I have some of the older Hitchens collected essays, like, you know, from like the 80s to like 1992, yeah. Right? And those are really great reads. They're very interesting. They're very left wing. I think it is worthwhile to remind people that there was this other chapter because people know that he made the shift, but people are sort of, I think, aren't as familiar with what happened before. So I'm really looking forward to being able to read that. Well, Ben, thank you so much for hanging out. Forward to reading the book and see you around.
See you, Ben.
All right, see you, Matt.
See you.
All right, y'all. We have a really fun segment coming up. Matt has a sort of.
I think we might bounce that to post game.
You think so?
What do you think? Yeah, I mean, we're getting up there now. I think
it makes sense. We went with Ben for a while. Yeah. Cool. So we'll do that in the post game. I do just want to say right now, while we have, you know, public feed, I want, and this is another thing that had to get bumped for time, but I just want to say again for people who've just joined. In the post game too, we're also going to do a conversation on this reconciliation infrastructure bill. I'm just saying my opinion on this is it has to be a no vote at this point. I mean, they have gutted everything worthwhile in it, and you can't continue playing this game with them. Make the Democrats own this kind of thing, make Sinema and Manchin own it, and also start pointing fingers at all these people behind the scenes, because what we're getting from, you know, publications like Politico, New York Times, Washington Post, are these accusations that there's plenty of other Democratic senators and congresspeople who are very happy to see all of these more, you know, substantive parts of the reconciliation infrastructure bill being gutted and not being the people who are sort of being forced to own it. So the progressives absolutely should be voting no on this. Make that wing of the Democratic Party own this. I don't know. The stakes are way too high to be sitting around with only spending $30 billion on kind of dubious climate change proposals in the first place. We need much, much, much more, and we need to be taking that fight directly to them. So anyways, we'll talk about that a little bit in the post game. Talk about Peter Thiel, and we'll also be taking questions from the Discord so you can get access to all of that, plus our bonus episode this weekend, Matt.
We got to play that annoying Obama clip, too, where he – I don't know if you've seen this one, but he's like, it's all your fault. Come on.
I did not have the heart to watch it yet. So we'll watch that live too.
It is so infuriating.
It's going to be a jam-packed post game. Don't want to miss that. Join us over at patreon.com/leftreckoning. You get the post games, you get the bonus episodes, which come out on Sundays. You get the monthly think tank.
Yeah, I just want to plug our upcoming show. We're going to be talking about Minneapolis politics. The patrons are going to get this probably Saturday, and we're going to release it, I think, early, at least portions of it for everybody else, so you know you can know how to vote for Minneapolis folks. But yeah, it is Jacob, and I want to get the podcast name right. I'm really excited to be – where did my DMs go? Oh, there they are. Okay. Yeah, so Jacob from – the MPLS, Money, Power, Land Solidarity podcast, MPLS. So look forward to that, patrons and public folks. You'll get that too. But if you want it earlier, if you want some listening on Saturday, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Wonderful. All right, we'll see you all in the post game.